It's Wednesday, April 8th, 2015, and this is KBIA's News of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. We're going to spend a good deal of time this week talking about what's in the Columbia Journalism School's report on Rolling Stone's story on rape at the University of Virginia. What's in it, the magazine and the reporter's subsequent apologies, how this could happen in the first place, and how the story is likely to be remembered months and years from now. And depending on time, we have a couple of other hot topics on the media beat that hopefully we'll get a chance to touch on as well. I want to start, though, with the nuts and bolts of that report. It was long, and I mean 12,000 words long. It was a scathing indictment of a failure of journalism at its most fundamental level. It uncovered lapses in reporting and editing and in fact-checking. If you haven't yet, you can read the full report on our links blog at kbia.org. Throughout the half hour, we're going to also be playing several clips from a news conference that was held on Monday, during which Steve Cole, the dean of the Columbia Journalism School, and Sheila Coronel, the dean of student affairs there, answered reporters' questions about their process and their final findings. Let's start with an overview of those findings. Sum it up for us.
Well, I mean, I'd say you had, from my perspective, the findings are you had a journalist who had a narrative already in her head. She had a source she was looking for as an extreme example of that narrative. When questions cropped up, or questions should have cropped up, both she and her editors decided to let it go because the story was just too good not to be true. And so you had failures at the reporting level, failures at the editing level. And then even though they had fact checkers who actually called into question some of this, they didn't listen to their fact checkers.
I think the other issue is that it sort of played into what's a common narrative of fraternities and what happens in frat houses and that sort of thing. And this story sort of fit that mold and they just ran with it. So I think that's what caused a lot of the problems as well.
Fit into a stereotype.
Fit into a stereotype, yes.
Rolling Stone retracted the story, replacing it online with the full text of the Columbia report, topped with a note from managing editor Will Dana. He apologized to readers, to the UVA community, and to the Phi Kappa Psi fraternity for the damage that the story caused. Would you have retracted the story?
Looking at this, yeah. You would have to retract the story. The problem with it is that, and this goes back to what Mike was talking about, is that they just did not do due diligence in talking to the main source and talking to other sources and seeking out information from the fraternity itself, from the university. They took this one common narrative and pretty much ran with it because it told a very good story. But that's not what journalism is. It's about checking all the facts and making sure that you're getting an accurate assessment of what's going on and what took place.
I mean, they had no choice but to retract the story. I quibble with the fact that in retracting it, they took the story offline and replaced it with the Columbia Journalism School report. Now, people have cached that somewhere. If you want to get a hold of it, you can find
it. In fact, it was actually in that Columbia Journalism press conference. They actually mentioned it is available through the Wayback Machine, which, ironically enough, that same day, Mike, you came and guest lectured in one of my classes teaching students exactly how that works.
Right.
Tell our audience about it.
Fortunately, I mean, you know, the folks at the Internet Archive collect, they sample from the Internet important stuff, and they keep it on their own servers so that if a news organization goes away or they change their content management, whatever happens, there's a record of historically important stuff. And it's good to know that that record is being kept of this story.
Well, reporter Sabrina Rubin Eardley also issued her own apology, which said in part, quote, "I have often dealt with sensitive topics and sources. In writing each of these stories, I must weigh my compassion against my journalistic duty to find the truth. However, in this case of Jackie and her account of her traumatic rape, I did not go far enough to verify her story. I allowed my concern for Jackie's well-being, my fear of re-traumatizing her, and my confidence in her credibility to take the place of more questioning and of more facts. These are mistakes I will not make again. Reporting on rape has unique challenges, but the journalist still has the responsibility to get it right. I hope that my mistakes in reporting this story do not silence the voices of victims that need to be heard." tough to read, tough to write, I'm sure for her. How effective an apology is this?
I think it was an effective apology. I think she sort of owned up to the fact that, you know, she didn't do due diligence and verification, and that's very important. But I also want to speak on the point that she made at the end, which is you don't want this sort of huge mistake in journalism to sort of overshadow the larger issue of domestic violence, especially on college campuses, and our campus and other campuses are dealing with that. And that's a larger story. So we should not let that issue sort of die down.
If there is any good to come of all of this, it's how this story back in November at its original publication really sparked that conversation. We spent close to an entire episode of this show talking about it.
I hope that that's true. And I do think the apology is sincere, mm-hmm. but I also think, unfortunately, a lot of damage has already been done, not the least of which is to that false narrative that a lot of people have, that there's a lot of women out there who are falsifying reports of rape. But there's also been damage done to the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. There's been damage done to that fraternity. And I think there's really been some serious damage done to whether or not other journalists are going to want to step into this story and do the kind of reporting that's necessary to illuminate these problems.
And that's what I'm scared of, the fact that you're going to have journalists who are going to question, maybe overly question, some of the stories that are coming out from women who have been traumatized. But also you're going to have women who are not going to want to come out and tell their stories because this happened. And it's one of those things where in trying to do that verification, you can easily re-traumatize the person who was basically the victim.
So potentially a chilling effect from more than one side. The idea of the potential victim who doesn't want to come forward and talk out of fear that they will be re-traumatized, re-victimized in telling their story. And then also a chilling effect on the part of journalists who maybe don't want to be the one to engage in that.
You know, another thing in her apology that I found kind of interesting is she talked about how she relied on her belief in the credibility of Jackie. Well, what did she draw that credibility for? How did she assess that? Because she told a compelling story? I mean, we don't know what happened to Jackie. It's possible something bad did happen to her, but the evidence just doesn't point to this particular thing having happened. But that being the case, how does a journalist determine whether or not a sympathetic character is credible if you're not asking questions like, what does the other side say? What do the people you accuse have to say? What do your friends have to say? If you don't do basic journalism, how do you assess credibility?
And to me, that's where editors come into play. There had to have been, there should have been, some editors at the Rolling Stone who asked those questions before it even got to the point of even thinking about publishing it. And that, I think, is what the Columbia Journalism Report actually spelled out, is that there was not due diligence on the part of the editors.
And we're going to actually listen to a clip right now from one of those first clips we're going to listen to from that news conference, where the folks from Columbia Journalism School asked, how could it happen?
The problems we outlined, there were problems of methodology. There are problems of newsroom standards and procedures. They had nothing to do. I mean, those were the key issues of our report. We don't believe that in this case, Jackie was to blame.
Flat out, whose fault was this?
Well, it was the collective fault of the reporter, the editor's supervisor, and the fact-checking department.
It wasn't Jackie. That was kind of one of those things, too, looking back in some of the statements in the editor's note, that perhaps management at Rolling Stone still not 100% ready to clear Jackie in this case.
Well, I mean, Jackie told her story. Mm-hmm. She told her story as she saw it. It's the reporter's responsibility and the editor's who are supposed to be backing up and making sure that everything is done right. It is their responsibility to verify Jackie's story, to get all the other facts, to make sure that there's proper context and due diligence in doing that. And that didn't take place because they fell in love with the narrative and they ran with it.
Yeah, I think that's the one step that maybe, and I think this was a fabulous report. I think the Columbia Journalism School people did a really good job of researching this. But I think they're one step removed from how could this have happened, because I don't think they talked enough about the fact that this was a story that was just too good to be true. It fit into the narrative that they wanted to believe. The reporter came into this story already with a preconceived notion of where this story was going. All the other stuff flowed from that.
One of the other things that was talked about at length in this news conference, and you can watch the full hour-long news conference on our links blog at kbia.org. One point that they wanted to make clear was that it really was certain to them that Eardley had spent her time doing reporting, that she wasn't on any tight deadline pressure to do this story, to rush through the interviews in any way. And it sounded like she could have walked away from the whole project at any time if she felt there was a reason to, which leads to a bit of a different question. How did the narrative writing style, so common to long-form magazine writing, factor into this? The use of Jackie as a single source and trying to tell her story in a way that flowed and wasn't necessarily broken up through repeated attribution by saying that she said those things over and over again about what happened to her at the Phi Kappa Psi house.
There is a tension in narrative writing between constantly putting in she said, according to her, and the flow that a reader ideally is looking for on the page. But and so we think there's room for some diverse voicing in magazine writing, but when the reporting is solid and when attribution is fundamental to a reader's understanding, as it was in some of those instances, you just have to do it, even if it breaks up the flow.
This kind of became the day two and day three story after this report came out, was a look at the greater issues that come with long-form narrative writing, and that sometimes telling a good story that reads like a yarn may not always be good journalism.
Well, how you tell a story is important, but it can't overshadow the facts and doing due diligence and making sure that you've verified the information and that the audience understands where this information is coming from and who's saying it. I think sometimes as writers, we get so caught up in how we're presenting the story that we forget about who we're presenting the story to.
And we need to be careful not to be overly critical of the form. I mean, we teach most of our students in this school that finding what we call a compelling central character mm-hmm. around whom to tell the story, somebody we can empathize with or understand or see it through their eyes, or that's a really good way of getting people to understand a story. But it's not the only thing that you do. And it seems to me that the Rolling Stone decided that that was really their only obligation, was to find this really compelling character, and to heck with all the other reporting and analysis and context that you would normally do to back up that character's story.
Well, and I'm all for character-driven stories, and maybe that's one of my deficiencies as a journalist, is I'm not real good at writing in that narrative style. Sure, I can tell someone's story. I can make them somebody that we can connect with and empathize with, but I find myself going out of my way, and I think this was one of the problems with this story, of always including that attribution. So even if it's, you know, she says that the bag of potatoes was heavy, I'm not going to just take for granted because I see her wincing as I'm shooting video that it's heavy. I want her to tell me that it's heavy so that I can attribute that to her.
But I think you can write in that style and still provide the necessary attributions so that the reader understands that you've done your due diligence. And the problem here is that you don't see those other voices. That to me is, you hear her voice, but you don't hear the voice of her friends. You don't hear the voice of those that she's accusing. You don't hear the university's voice. You don't hear the voice of a total investigation into exactly what happened.
Yeah, I mean, there was a similar criticism about, and the Rolling Stone said they were going to stop using pseudonyms for mm-hmm. characters in their stories.
Which is one of the recommendations to come out of it.
Using the pseudonym in and of itself is not a problem, but the reporters and the editors have to know the real persons behind those pseudonyms. In this story, they have applied a name to somebody they didn't even know who they were, and they never attempted to contact them.
See, and going back to what we were talking about a little bit ago, actually this decision to stop using pseudonyms, in some ways, isn't that a little bit dangerous when we talk about that chilling effect of people who aren't willing to come forward, that idea of kind of having a blanket decision not to grant anonymity? There may still be a case down the line where you want or need to do that.
Yeah, there are cases in which you do want to do that, but that still does not absolve you from the responsibility of making sure that what that person is saying is accurate, and that you can verify that. You make the choice to use a pseudonym to protect them, but it doesn't, who's protecting the audience from that story not being accurate, right, not doing the verification? That's the responsibility of the news organization.
The editor and charge at that point.
Right, exactly.
One of the biggest shocks, to me at least, is that no one at Rolling Stone will be losing their jobs over this, and Sabrina Early will continue to write for the magazine. ABC's David Wright asked the Columbia Journalism deans about that.
Your report is framed as a matter of journalistic best practices. And on the accountability question, I wonder, if it were your newsroom, shouldn't somebody lose their job?
Well, as you know, as a veteran newsman, hypotheticals are a very usually kind of an unhelpful question. I would say that...
Still, that's a kind of accountability, and that's a big statement of accountability, isn't it?
It is a big statement of accountability, and it belongs with Rolling Stone. Look, we're not the DA's office here. We're not a special prosecutor. We did not find, and as we say in the report, we didn't find evidence of the kind of dishonesty, invention of facts, lying to colleagues, plagiarism, that in our experience and probably yours, you would regard as grounds for automatic firing or severe sanctions. Absent that kind of dishonesty, it just didn't seem appropriate for us to judge individuals who we have only met through the context of reporting on a single story. They've been employed at Rolling Stone for decades, and so it's appropriate for Rolling Stone to sort out that accountability.
I don't know. I would guess that at some point in our careers, we have each known somebody who's lost their job over one really bad decision.
I mean, okay, they can make that argument, but I have to say it wasn't a hypothetical question. These are real people who were involved in real and wrong decisions. Somebody should be held accountable. I mean, if you ask me, this is almost worse than, you know, firing somebody because they made up a story. It's harder to detect when people are sometimes really good at lying. Jason Blair was really good at lying. It's harder to ferret that out than it is to say, you just didn't follow Journalism 101. And if you can't do that at a publication of the quality of Rolling Stone, then somebody needs to pay. And there's only one person, I think, in that report that doesn't deserve to pay, and that's the anonymous fact checker. They decided not to name them because the fact checker did come up and say, you really ought to look into this stuff. The reporter and the editors ignored that advice.
Yeah, I think there definitely needs to be some accountability. I'm not as quick as some others to say that people should lose their jobs because, you know, they've worked all their lives to have these careers, and there still should be some sort of accountability. But I think even more importantly is that the system itself, the culture that allowed these things to happen. Someone needs to be accountable to making sure that is changed and that this doesn't occur again. And what tends to happen in these things is that by firing someone or telling someone that they have to leave, the system itself sort of remains the same and it can occur again.
And, you know, there's one other bit of accountability that's missing, not for the fault of the journalism faculty not asking the questions, but what about the lawyers? There were lawyers at the Rolling Stone, as there are lawyers on retainer for every major news organization in America.
And minor news organizations.
Who are asked to vet this stuff.
Yes.
The lawyers refuse to comment. So we don't have any idea what kind of accountability they should be held to. Somebody on the legal staff should have said, come on, you never tried to contact the person who's being accused. You never tried to contact the friends. The lawyers.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, the lawyers may have said all that.
It does say, but wouldn't there be kind of client privilege there too?
Well, there
could be. Client attorney privilege.
It could be. I mean, the lawyers may have said all that, but the narrative, as you said, Mike, the narrative was so good. It was so compelling. It fit everything that we were looking for that we just have to run with it.
Yeah.
And so they may have just said to the lawyers, you know, thanks, but no thanks. We hear your advice, but we're not going to take it and just run with it.
So, Ernest, this may be an unfair question to ask, but you're our historian. You're our expert in how things are remembered and how they are then brought forth in perpetuity. How do you predict this story is going to be remembered in the annals of American journalism?
Well, I think this is gonna go down in the same vein that Jason Blair and others have gone down. And the question becomes, are we gonna learn from this? There are some things that we did learn from Jason Blair. The problem is that a lot of the things that journalism didn't do in Jason Blair, mm-hmm. they didn't do in this case, which is the whole verification thing again. It goes back to what I was talking about earlier. You can get rid of people, but if your system and your culture remains the same, this is going to crop up again. And I think over and over again, within journalism, we have this culture of finding narratives, finding mm-hmm. stories that really sort of hit home with an audience, but we haven't done due diligence and they come to backfire on us when we don't do the verification.
It's a story that's so good, the facts get in the way.
Right.
And I think, Ernest, you'd agree with this too. Maybe even a better comparison would be not with Jason Blair or any of these fabulists or plagiarists, but it would be stories like the Duke Lacrosse story or Dan Rather and Rathergate, you know, where journalists didn't cheat, but they should have known better.
They should have known, but no, you're absolutely right. And if you go back and you look at those, like, you know, I go to again, we have to change our systems to make sure that we're doing this. There needs to be more. We need to challenge. We need to challenge sources. You can sort of believe their story, but you got to challenge with passion, as we tell our students, some of the things that they're saying so that things can be verified.
And yet the Rolling Stones editors made a point of saying, we don't really need to change our practices. We just need to follow the rules that we have better next time.
Well,
follow them this time.
I mean, you know, when I hear that, I'm going like, but it was your systems that got you into trouble to begin with, because you put the systems in place, you don't follow them. That's a part of the culture. Yeah. You got to change the culture.
So I want to go back for one last clip to that Columbia J School News conference. The New York Times, Ravi Somaiya, asked this rather fair question of them.
You guys have been immersed in Rolling Stone's editorial process for some months now. Do the two of you trust what you read in the magazine now?
Being very, we're empiricists. Unless, you know, there is evidence to the contrary, we would, you know, judge each story on its merits. Yeah.
Kind of a non-answer there, I guess. We've seen other publications find themselves in the shadow of controversy and somehow make it out the other end and do okay. What do you see happening here for Rolling Stone?
Well, I mean, I think Rolling Stone is gonna find a way out of this. The question becomes, the problem becomes, is if this happens again, what kind of credibility issues are they going to have? I mean, you're going to have some people.
Fool me once, shame on you. Exactly. Fool me twice, shame on me.
And you're going to have people who are not going to go back to Rolling Stone because of this, especially a lot of women who really trusted that journalism, and then they see this. And then also institutions are the same way. They're not going to trust Rolling Stone because of this. But I think that if they can get back to a lot of the journalism that they practice, if they can make sure they do due diligence, if they can do those types of things, change that culture, I think they can be able to rebuild their credibility. New York Times was able to do it after what happened with Jason Blair. CBS News has been able to come back after Rathergate. It's possible for that to happen.
Okay, here's Mr. Cynic coming out again. I don't think Rolling Stone is going to have as hard a job as CBS News or the New York Times had for a variety of reasons. One, they're still read primarily for their reports on music and celebrities, mm-hmm. not for their investigative journalism.
Good
they
point.
Could probably
Good
do
point.
Less investigative journalism, won't affect their audience a single bit. Two, there's so many scandals du jour today that we're going to forget about this one. The audience, at least, is going to forget about it very quickly if they haven't forgotten about it already. It's mostly journalism types who are doing
navel
gazing right now.
Conversation.
So I just don't think that they're going to have any permanent damage to their reputation. And in some ways, I think that they might be inclined to not try as hard as they should to salvage their reputation because they don't have to.
But the one thing I don't want us to forget, neither the journalists nor the audience, is that the issue that this story brought about, which is still out there, and that is sexual violence. And I think, and domestic violence, I think it's something that we in journalism are uniquely capable of presenting those stories and that issue to the public. And I think it's our responsibility to do that. And my fear is that we're going to be afraid to do some of that because of what this report came.
Well, interesting you should mention that. Before we move on to another topic, I want to remind our audience here in Mid-Missouri that tomorrow that conversation will continue here in Columbia, the Missouri Center for Documentary Journalism here at the School of Journalism, in connection with Ragtag, True False, based on a true story, is screening The Hunting Ground at the Missouri Theater. I've heard the film described as a relentless look at sexual assault and rape culture on college campuses. We'll include ticket information on our website. One of the things that we're proud of here at the School of Journalism is some of the bleeding edge work we're doing with mobile journalism, using smartphones and tablets as our cameras, writing, editing, and publishing tools. Well, two new apps hit the market in the last few weeks, and they could prove to be game changers. Meerkat and Periscope let people live stream video and share it through Twitter. Already, some folks are using these apps to stream news events, looking at different spot news events, the building explosion in New York being one that comes to mind. We have an article on our links blog in which the managing editor of Bloomberg Politics says these apps turn us all into C-SPAN.
Yeah, I think there is an upside. I mean, you're democratizing journalism. You're having more people who are able to capture things, for example, like the shooting in South Carolina. If we hadn't had that cell phone video, that cop probably would not have been charged with killing that man. But there are also downsides to it, I mean, that we have to be careful about. I think it makes it even more tempting for us to go with video before we've done a good job of verifying it. Hey, it's coming in live. We can grab it. Let's put it on there now. And I also think you have some very specific things we have to worry about. You had an image on our links blog that people should look at, which suggests what could happen in the coverage of hostage situations. Mm-hmm. Because now it's not just journalists that have to be careful not to show things that might compromise in a rescue attempt, but you got everybody with a cell phone who could be doing the same thing.
I also think you got some serious privacy issues here. And I know that that is going to be, at least I believe that it's going to be a huge issue in the upcoming presidential election and other elections, because with everyone having a cell phone and everyone feeling as if, you know, that whatever they video, they can put up online, you're going to have some people going to go, whoa, wait a minute, you know, that's me, that's my image, this is who I am, and you don't have the right to take my image and what I do and put it out before the world without my permission.
I think we're going to have another thing too along those same lines, a concern about copyright issues. I was, especially as a lot of journalists, I like to call it shiny new thing syndrome, that as soon as something new comes on the market, there are folks who want to be the first ones to use it and try it out. And I was wondering who would be the first person to go try and use Periscope or Meerkat at the Final Four and then end up getting in trouble for live streaming something going on in the arena or somewhere in Indianapolis that CBS would own the rights to and have CBS go after them
for
copyright.
Or a concert. I can tell you exactly. Uh-huh. I mean, or any sporting event. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have the Masters Golf Tournament coming up. And I mean, one of the things that the PGA has been trying forever is to keep people from using their cell phones at these tournaments, and they're doing it and they're putting it up. And that just causes a whole lot of issues in terms of copyright and ownership by these people, by these corporations who are paying thousands of dollars in order to be able to put these things on the
air. I have to think, in the same way we had conversations about BuzzFeed taking photos off the internet they didn't have rights to, it's not going to be all that long before we're having a conversation here around this table about somebody live streaming something on Meerkat or Periscope who were in that same situation.
Right. I think that we don't have time to tell this story right now, but people should look into also how Twitter managed to overcome the we're first syndrome, mm-hmm. because Meerkat came out first. Everybody had the buzz around them. Twitter figured out how to rapidly get out a similar product. And when you've got these big players involved, and they're not journalism companies doing this, it's a really interesting story.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. There's another story on our links blog I want to invite you to check out, taking a look at an investigation that the Associated Press has done in the last few weeks, taking a look at possible slavery, modern-day slavery in Asia, and how fish that we are eating and buying in our supermarkets here in the United States is caught. Thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today and others on our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments, questions, and see previews of what we'll be talking about next week and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan and Maya Jackson for directing the show today, and Pat Akers for handling the audio. Kristen Wollring is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week.